Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and today I have the pleasure of speaking to the scholars from the edge of time, Nicholas Dyack and Michelle Brittany. Greetings and welcome.
Hello, Hercules. Happy Christmas Eve.
Thank you. The same to you, too.
Good evening, Hercules. It's good to hear your voice.
Same here. Are you guys celebrating the season in any particular way?
Chinese food. since we adopted our cats 3 years ago, in fact, we just had our three-year anniversary of our kitties yesterday.
Yesterday.
Yay.
Yeah.
When we first adopted them, they were just small little kittens, and we didn't want to leave them long. And so this is when we lived in California. There was a Chinese restaurant like a block away. So we just sped there, got food, sped back home. So we just, had Chinese food of our kitties. And We just kind of been doing since, because I associate, Christmas, kitties, Chinese food. You got some alliteration going on there, I guess.
Sure,
well,
yeah.
We Die Hard for Christmas.
We do watch Die Hard, but... If we're gonna watch it this year, we'll probably have to stream it because our copy of Die Hard's in a box somewhere.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But that's our other thing. That's our Christmas movies, Die Hard. And I know we're on a sword and sandal podcast, but darn it,
that's
Die Hard.
but we can make the connection through The Fifth Element with Bruce Willis, and Fifth Element was also directed by Luc Besson, who is the director of our movie that we're discussing this evening, Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets.
Did you just 5 degrees Kevin Bacon our podcast tonight?
Why not?
Yeah, why not? I agree. That used to be a graphic novel series or comic book series back in the day, I believe.
Yeah. In fact, for Christmas a couple years ago, Michelle got me a couple issues of it, and I've got it on the shelf over there. The intent was to write some essays for the Journal of Graphic Novels and Comics for her. I'm sorry, Michelle. I failed you. Those essays never materialized. But we had other writing adventures since.
Yes, we have.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Comics, I mean, French comics. And I will say this. I've got a soft spot for, late 70s and 80s European comics, that era of heavy metal. So probably my favorite was actually done by an American working with a French person. That was the Kelly Green series that has a strong French, put out by the same publisher as Valerian, Garong, whatever. Or a G. One of the two. There, that's right there. Dargod. Anyway, so a comic book series from back in the day after 40 years turned into a movie.
So to give a little more concrete, originated from 1967 and finished up in 2018.
Whoa, that's quite the run.
Yeah, and I think there's 21 what they call albums, but 21 stories. They have been actually translated and published in English by Cinebook, and I think that was probably around 2020 maybe, or maybe a year or two prior to that, in which they printed everything in one volume, I believe. So they are available in English.
That sounds like it should have been a Fantagraphics project instead.
I'm actually surprised that it wasn't.
Well, one other thing real quick is, this is our continuation of our Sword and Planet dialogue. The last time we were on your show, we talked about John Carter. The time before that, we talked about Ice Pirates. So we're here today to continue our Sword and Planet conversation with Valerian and a City of a Thousand Planets.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds great to me.
So I have a plot synopsis, but a warning before I read this. One of the faults of this film is it does meander. it meanders greatly. This movie sees something shiny and goes for it, and it takes a while for it to steady its course. Because of that, I've kind of omitted a lot of the meandering, said, at least get a one-page plot here, or else I'm going to spend an hour to go through every side quest and nook and cranny of this plot. So here we go. On the planet Mole, a race of tropical folk harvest pearls from the ocean, pearls that have megatons of power inside them. They then feed these pearls to converters, cute little porcupine-looking critters that duplicate items fed to it by, I'm going to say they poop it out.
They do.
They poop it out. So you feed it one pearl, it poops out 50 pearls. You feed it a coin, it poops out 50 coins. I mean, it's not, whatever. Unless there's another horse that's there.
Yeah, that's just to give you a visual.
But it's a cute critter, though. It looks like a little porcupine possum thing with a little snout.
Or a gecko, chameleon, dragon-looking thing. But really very much on the cute side.
Yeah. So, however, high above the planet, there's an intergalactic war being fought. And so two races of people are pew-pew-pewing each other. And what happens is a giant capital starship gets hit, and it crashes into the planet Mole, and it creates an extinction event and annihilates everyone on the planet. And Princess Liho, she's one of the royalty there, she's obliterated in the blast, but she sends her soul out through space and time. And 30 years later, pow, it finds a home in Valerian, a galactic secret agent who's on a secret mission with his secret agent partner, Lori Line. Now, their mission at the start of the film is they're going to infiltrate big market, huge, sprawling, megaopolis, shopping city market that's like, it's a cyberpunk city that goes deep into the earth, and it's just basically a huge bazaar.
But you can't see it.
Because it exists in a different dimension.
Yes.
Ah.
So, yeah.
It's almost like having a cloaking device in a way, but you have to have a special kind of helmet with vision that allows you to be able to see this other dimension.
Yeah, if you don't see the other dimension, you just see this giant desert scape of people just kind of wandering around. Like, what are they doing? No, because they've got a headset and they're peering into the dimension of big market. And so that's kind of a little joke that goes on because, you know, the characters are existing in two dimensions at the same time. Well, anyway, mm-hmm. They're infiltrating this dimensional market because they are sent to retrieve a stolen item. One of the last living converters, the cute little alien things that poop things. So to make a long story very short, they're successful.
Okay.
They return to Alpha City.
With a lot of violence in there.
Yeah, there's some shooting and violence and critters and, you know, the typical Indiana Jones sequence where Indiana Jones is in a market and everyone's chasing him and he's going pew, pew, pew and jumping over barrels and stuff. The exact same scene, but it's cyberpunky and in different dimensions. So they're successful in their mission and they return to Alpha City, which is this huge space station that just kind of got bigger and bigger over the centuries, like a giant Katamari ball. Like the space station like started off like as the ISS on Earth, and they kept adding modules and modules and modules, and then aliens said, hey, we want to help out, and they added their modules, and it just grew into this big, basically a small moon, and so because it was so big on Earth, they just sent it out into space, and it just kept growing and growing. So what you have is this giant space station that has millions of people on it, and there's different sectors of different, like, ecosystems and environments. You know, there's, like, an underwater city, there's a city made of electronic gold, and you know, it's just really, it's really cool actually,
and all these things are interconnected.
Yeah.
Which gives rise to the part of the title, which is the City of a Thousand Planets.
Yes, that's why it's called that. So Valerian and Loreline, they're successful in their mission. They go back to Alpha City, but a new mission awaits for them. There's a threat. In the heart of Alpha, there's this giant radiation packet, and it's growing. Now, Captain Fillet, not Captain, Commander Fillet, who's Clive Owen, is going to go investigate and take a battalion of men, but he gets kidnapped by the survivors of the planet Mole. So they kidnap him. Oh, my God. So Valerian gives chase, and he goes into the radioactive zone, and he disappears. Loreline goes after him. She finds him. Then she gets kidnapped. Then Valerian goes and saves her. And this kind of goes back and forth until they finally get to the heart of the city. I just truncated an hour with that. Turns out the survivors of Mool have built like a holographic replica of their destroyed planet. And in order to make it like run, they need a pearl and that last converter. And also turns out Commander Fillet, who's really Clive Owen, is the one who gave the orders to destroy their planet. So, of course, he's the bad guy. And then a giant firefight breaks out because, of course, and the good guys win. Valerian and Loreline give the Mool people their converter back along with the pearl, and they speed off into the galaxy, and Valerian and Loreline do some smooching. The end.
Wow.
I purposely left out some stuff so we could talk about character development.
Oh, okay, because I was like, wow, there's a lot of stuff left out of that. But you went right to the chase.
I went to the chase because this is a film that probably should have been a TV series because every meandering could have
been
its own
episode.
Yeah, because what I'm skipping out on is there's a submarine scene, there's a brothel scene, there's a sordid planet scene, there's a a cyberpunk market city scene that's actually elaborated on. There's all this stuff, and it makes it for a really cool world. It's just that you've only got a short time to, you know, condense all these elements. And so what you're left with is a movie that's ambitious and has a lot of cool ideas, but you're at the buffet, and your plate can only hold so much. And they tried to do it.
Yeah, I think they tried to take a sample of all the dishes and try to hold it into the one Chinette plate, and it didn't quite work.
Yeah, that's probably a good way to put it. And what they grabbed is also some flavors that probably don't go well together. They probably got a slice of cheesecake, and then they put split pea soup on the plate right next to it so it oozes over.
Yeah, I think that there's definitely, you know, some overlap that really didn't work out very well.
But to kind of sum up, we're sounding like we're disparaging the film, and maybe we kind of are. It is better than John Carter that we talked about 2 months ago. And we've watched this film twice now, once about when it first came out, and the second time revisiting it for this episode of the podcast. And we did wind up liking the movie much more the second time around because we kind of knew what to expect. And really the greatest flaw of this film, not necessarily its meandering, it's the two main characters.
Well, and I wouldn't say that it is a problem.
It is a big problem.
And I think there was a problem with the casting of one person specifically.
But it creates a dual problem. When one goes down, the other one goes down with them.
Yeah, so if you want to start that.
When we talked about John Carter 2 months ago, one of our umbrages was the guy that played John Carter was so nondescript. And he didn't have any charisma. And the person that played Deja Force, she was fine. You know, she was not the typical damsel in distress. She can actually hold her own. She was actually very interesting. While John Carter was just John Carter. This film kind of has the opposite approach. The main guy is trying to be with like this. He looks like a little kid that's impersonating Sylvester Stallone with his voice. He's so youthful looking, and like that's fine, but he talks really deep. And I love you, Loreline, and I'm gonna marry you. But first, I'm a government agent. But he's like 12, and he's trying to put on a tough guy, but also a ladies' man persona, and it's really cringy and really annoying. And he is not, he might be a smooth operator as an agent, but like as a James Bond, you know, he's falling into, he's trying to be a Roger Moore style while also trying to be a Daniel Craig action guy, and but he's not smooth like Roger Moore at all.
Yeah, I think that unfortunately he does look very youthful. And counters to the image of what you expect Valerian to be. I actually read the first volume of the comic book series, and you know, we're expecting a hero that's, you know, 6 feet tall. He's kind. He's passionate. But he's also a, kind of a manly man. He's the hero. He's on his hero's journey, and it's kind of, I think part of the problem with the Valerian in the film is that he's so adamant that he wants Loreline as his wife, and it's not sincere.
It's not sincere, but it's also kind of weird because she's his coworker. Now, I haven't read the comics. I'm just going to take the movie at face value. When your secret agent partner is also your love interest, I mean, that can work. I mean, the movie True Lies, that's the ending of True Lies, is Arnold Schwarzenegger and Jamie Lee Curtis join up as a husband and wife duo.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that movie makes it work. This one is like, you know, they're two, 006 and 007, and 007 is trying to get into 006's knickers. Okay, I know 006 is Sean Bean, but
yeah, you know what, where are you going with that?
But you see what I'm saying is that there shouldn't be a love interest there. They are secret agents. They're supposed to kind of have, I mean, they do have each other's backs, but, you know, it's kind of, it's an awkward secret agent working environment, I think.
Yeah, and it's kind of counter to the focus of the comic books, which is, you know, a focus on feminism and nature. And I mean, I think we get some of those themes in the film, but this relationship that is
forced.
It feels forced through the entire movie, and it doesn't work. And as a result, I don't think that the casting of what's his name, Dane DeHaan, was a good choice here. And I really wish they didn't do the whole, I'm in love with you, I want to marry you.
Right off the bat, that's like his first sentence to her when we first meet him.
Yeah, and it's kind of like, I think there was a lot of strength on the story if they would have just gone with the story and had the more, I think buddy-buddy would have been fine.
Yeah, there's two solutions to the story. One, get rid of, you could keep the main actor, and let him be a secret agent and ditch the love angle.
I think it would have been better. He would have been a better fit. But with the love story, I think he's not.
Or if you have to keep the love story, then you need a better actor. The lady, the person that plays Loreline, Cara Delevingne, I know she kind of gets a little bit of flack for kind of poor acting. She's actually the only one that really holds up herself because she rebuts his advances. She's actually the one taking mostly everything seriously. And you know what it is, I think, about the guy who plays Valerian? He's kind of like a Tom Cruise type character where he's kind of smiling and winking at everything, but also trying to be a tough guy at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's issues here. He's trying to be a Tom Cruise maverick, and he can't do it. Cruise can barely do it.
Well, and I think that's a big part of why I didn't care for this film the first time we watched it,
mm-hmm.
is that I was kind of anticipating a somewhat serious, mm-hmm. and then it really is a tongue-in-cheek and kind of a, you know, hoodwink and, you know, this and that. And it's not meant to be as serious as I thought the film was supposed to be. So I think, you know, knowing that going into the second viewing was much easier, and I liked the film better the second time around.
Since we went into it knowing that the main dude is rubbish and their chemistry is poof, we were able to at least take in what the movie's biggest strength was, which is the spectacle, which is the titular you know, City of a Thousand Planets. And Luc Besson, you know, he gave us The Fifth Element, which was a cyberpunk film with space elements. Mm-hmm. He got big floating cities that extend for miles into the Earth and capital ships and lots of alien races everywhere. And this movie just takes all that and ramps it to 11, just like in a...
Yeah.
and that's where it's successful at, even mm-hmm. though it doesn't cohesively do it because it meanders, but it's still, there's a lot of, oh, wow, oh, that's neat, oh, that's cool type elements.
Well, and I almost feel that Besson was basically laying the groundwork. And we've had these conversations before where when it's the first one and you're kind of anticipating that you're going to get a chance to do more, you kind of strategically try to figure out, okay, how do I kind of build this world, tell a story, make money so that I can do sequels?
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that that's why we got the meandering, why we got kind of this kind of flash look at this humongous floating City of a Thousand Planets,
uh-huh.
want to see more, but then not get quite the story that we,
yeah,
that would have been successful.
Yeah, there's a sequence where Valerian is giving chase to try to get the commander back, and mm-hmm. the joke is, like, what's the shortest way to get to the guy? And Lorian Lyon's like, you know, go 180 degrees that way. He's like, well, that's a wall. Well, you said this is the shortest distance. So he has a special power suit, so he crashes through the wall and basically runs a straight line. And, you know, the gag is he's basically running through a lot of different, I'm going to say air quotes, rooms, but, you know, each room it's a different aspect of the city. At one point, he's in the water swimming. Another point, he's, like, kind of in a deserty area. Another point, he's, like, in a Judge Dredd Mega City 1 type area. And, you know, they're just quick flashes that, one, is kind of cool. It gives you a scope of the city, all the different environments in, and maybe it's a little teasing because those are some of the only glimpses that you get of just how grand Alpha City is.
Yeah.
Mm. It sounds like they're going to make sequels, like you guys pointed out. And I guess the reasons they didn't are because of what you're sharing in your views.
Yeah, I mean, just like John Carter, even though we didn't care for the main guy in John Carter, you know, it was still a big epic story that at the end we're like, well, that's it. We still wouldn't mind a little bit more. And I think it's the same thing for Valerian, especially, if I may. I think the setting in Valerian with all the different planets and the giant Alpha City is actually more interesting than Edgar Rice Burroughs' Mars or Barsoom, which is a bit more, and again, I'm going by just what we saw in the film, which is more, you know, sand and rock everywhere, which is fine for movies like Stargate, where, you know, Roland Emmerich actually can really bring a life out of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, John Carter trying to squeeze blood from a rock, and all they got was more rock.
Yeah.
But I'm going to use that as a segue, though, to talk about, because right now what we've mostly been talking about is that this movie is a space opera. And mm-hmm. a lot of space operas are based off of the Sword and Planet / planetary romance genre. And this movie is no exception. There is an actual Sword and Planet sequence in the film. About halfway through the movie, depending on your definition of halfway, Lorian gets kidnapped by a race of aliens, and they're these CGI aliens that kind of look like the Thark from the John Carter films. They're not insecty like the Thark. They're kind of more bulbous, but they're CGI critters nonetheless.
And for people that know the movie, their creatures are the Brunon Bathors.
Yeah.
And what they're known as.
And they can't speak English, so the only dialogue you get from them is various grunts and groans. They're kind of tribal, so they've got feathers and necklaces, so it's a little, you know, Edgar Rice Burroughs Tarzan-y at the same time.
Yeah.
But, like, they're part of Alpha City is, like, basically a stone fortress that kind of, I'm going to say it looks kind of and the inside Jabba the Hutt-ish, where everything's kind of carved stone and big antechambers and a throne room.
And very grand.
Yeah.
Everything's on a very grand scale because these are larger creatures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're kind of rotund and they're a little silly looking. But yeah, the throne room that their emperor's in is big and huge.
It's massive. I would say like a Star Wars type epic.
You know, in those new Star Wars films, you always have that throne room sequence where, you know, the shot is way off in the distance and everyone looks like ants as they approach the throne, then it starts zooming in on them. It's kind of like that, although it's not shot that way. Well, anyway, Loreline gets kidnapped by these folks, and she's going to be fed to their emperor because the emperor's a really big, fat guy that, you know, that they line up to give him food, and he takes a bite and spits it out because he doesn't like it. But man, oh man, he really wants to eat Loreline. So Valerian infiltrates their fortress and, you know, saves her, classic Sword and Planet style, where basically Valerian is the John Carter surrogate and Loreline's the Deja Thor surrogate. And the critters, they fight with swords. Even though Valerian and Loreline, they've got blasters or space pistols and cloaking technology, they don't use any of that. It's a classic Sword and Planet sequence where everything is melee-based. The bad guys got shields and spears, and Valerian plucks up a sword, and, you know, fending off, you know, three people at the same time. You got, like, swashbuckling Robin Hood elements as, you know, flying around and stuff and kind of leaping around.
And mm-hmm. I think there's a sense of honor,
mm-hmm.
you know, and this was something that we talked about before, that while the technology is there with Valerian mm-hmm. And Loreline, you know, they're using what the other creatures are using because there is that base of honor, sense of honor, good and evil and things like that.
Well, if I may, there is a irony to all this because the outside of their fortress, it says no foreigners. And Valerian has to infiltrate. He actually gets Rihanna's help, Rihanna the singer, who has shape-shifting capabilities. That's a whole other meandering aspect of this movie. Helps him get in. The idea is no humans are supposed to be in there. If they are, it creates a diplomatic incident, and that's what they're trying to avoid. I get that. That's a very James Bondian thing. Mm-hmm. You know, so what do? They go in there and they assassinate the emperor and kill everyone anyway. what were you trying to do again? maybe that's going to be a post-credit sequence of, sir, we got a formal complaint of interdimensional incident. But I just think it's funny. They're trying so hard to, infiltrate in, tiptoe out, and they kill the emperor. And then they kill all the soldiers. Anyway.
But that's, that is typical.
That's typical of the genre.
Yeah, typical of the genre.
I guess it makes sense if you visit 1,000 planets.
You're going to lose a planet every once in a while, I guess.
So the movie is kind of, I'm going to call it in that wave of the neo-peplum, Sword and Planet films. Now, my book, shameless plug, there's an essay in it called Adding to New Spaces, Sword and Planets in the Neo-Peplum, and it's by Dr. Paul Johnson. And he takes a look at Tron 2, Jupiter Ascending, and John Carter, and he talks about how these are, you know, peplum films in space, you know, the use of CGI. He talks about, you know, the new type of muscle men hero, where the old Hercules films, you know, you've got the strong man, which, you know, today's equivalent would be The Rock. But most of the time, though, the hero in these types of films is not a strong man, but a more life-type character. You know, the main guy that plays Valerian, yeah, he's a good-looking guy, although he looks 12, but, you know, he's not buff. He's not strong. He does, you know, he has to rely on gadgets and pistols. And, I mean, he's a different kind of strong.
Well, to me, he's like an everyday man. He'd be like someone that you'd meet at the library or something.
Well, in a way, he's like James Bond, where James Bond has to have his gadgets from Q. in order for Valerian to be successful, you know, he's got to put his power suit on so he can run through the walls. He's got to have a cloaking device for his pistol so he can conceal it. He's got to have a special mouth breather that whose sole purpose is to release that little spider to get him out of the slimy cocoon.
But, it, you know, talking about James Bond, that's reminiscent of the little
rebreather
that Bond had in Thunderball.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the guy's obviously, I mean, he's a secret agent, so he's obviously leveraging James Bond. But, you know, these are all external devices.
Yes.
You know, not much, because, you know, in a classic Sword and Sandal and Sword and Planet, well, Sword and Sandal, the strength comes within. The swords are an extension of the strong man's body and his physical prowessness. Sword and Planet is, it's kind of like that, but, you know, something augments it. John Carter has to go to Mars, and the gravity of Mars is what makes him a superhero. And a lot of other stories follow that. The stories of, there's what, the Ganymede story, the Carson of Venus. You know, they all have something where the hero's not innately strong, but the world he's in makes him strong. Valerian is only strong because he has devices that make him strong.
Mm-hmm.
And if anything, it makes me think of another, it's a French Sword and Planet space fantasy book called The Enchanted Planet by Pierre Barbet, and this book sucks. I'm sorry, that's a different dialogue, different, but the planet the guy's on, it's like an illusion planet, so it makes me think of the dimension market, but the guy himself is, he's a wuss. In order for him to get by, he has to wear a special magic belt that gives him the abilities to be a medieval sword-slinging space hero. And Valerian is, in that way, he's kind of like a traditional Sword and Planet hero where he's not strong, but he's also a new type. He's more of the lithe, attractive, he's got a lot of agility, but he's just not like the rock buff. And the other thing I want to bring up during this planet sequence is the aliens themselves. This movie is CGI heavy. Sometimes it works. Actually, most of the time it works.
Yeah, I think it was, you know, for the spectacle, I think the CGI worked well.
But when they're dealing with the Sword and Planet aliens, the, what are they called?
The Bluon Bathars.
Yeah, they're very cartoony. They're cartoony in representation, cartoony in execution, and kind of cartoony in how they look. And
I didn't think that there was a whole lot of – they're meant to be primitive, so they're big, they're kind of rotund.
Yeah.
They're not like the type of aliens that like, oh, I want to be their best pal.
No.
So.
But they're also, they are, they're not the Uncanny Valley type aliens. A lot of the other aliens you can really buy into, like the Pearls of Mool, you know, that they're very lithe-looking mermaid people without tails. But I kind of buy into them.
Yeah, or like kind of the Avatar type character.
Or the three dudes. The three dudes. You know, I totally bought into them. What were they called?
They were the Shuli.
Yeah, there's
Shingu.
Yeah, when you do a space opera, you standard issue is you've got to have like a short critter that's cute, like Jawas and Ewoks. And in Valerian, they have the Shingu, which are these like, if you've ever read or watched Tintin, there's the characters of Thompson and Thompson. They're like identical twins that finish each other's sentences. These are those characters. They're information brokers.
Yeah, and in the movie, they're called the Dugan Dagoos. And they're kind of bird-like, with tails, and instead of a
anteaters.
Beak, they've got a snout. They look like aardvarks.
Aardvarks? I was going to say anteaters with long snoots.
Yeah.
They're kind of on, they're not as cute as the converters that poop.
That is true.
Okay.
But going back to the Bulon Bathors, what it kind of reminded me of is, you know, it's not the most convincing CGI, but it takes me back to the old Hercules films where he had monsters in them, but they're not exactly the most convincing monsters. I think specifically Hercules and the Conquest of Atlantis, where, let's just be honest, the critters in that Hercules film aren't fooling no one. They are... I'm sorry, Godzilla costume suits are more convincing than these things. And, you know, I just think that CGI aliens and monsters or whatever are just basically the replacement for this kind of, you got to suspend your disbelief for those types of, I mean, you know, those old movies didn't have the budget, you know, you may do with the papier-mâché critters. Not everything could have been a Ray Harryhausen skeleton. So I just think that's kind of, it keeps that traditional vein of those classic sword and sandal tales in a sword and plant story made today.
And how would you say that the Pearls of Mole fit in? Because they're kind of a, they're kind of like a little bit of a savage, but they're also more wealth and they're a different kind of hero in the film.
You know what? When I was thinking of them, I wasn't thinking sword and planet at all, just because there's no swords.
No, but they have.
And there's no Greek elements. But you know what I was thinking of? Remember when we read Swords Against Cthulhu and we read that one islandy story?
Yeah, I think the first one. Maybe it was the second one. Yes, I remember.
It's called like the sword. I think it even started with an M. That's what it reminded me of. It's kind of, and again, that story still had sword and sandal elements because there was an arena that they fought Cthulhu in and critters everywhere. Oh, man, I kind of want to look that up. But anyway, I was thinking of them for some odd reason because I know that there's aquatic sword and sandal out there. It's pretty rare, but I know some things kind of dive into it. So, but you know, I think it's because they were more like peaceful people and they didn't have weapons. To me, they felt
but they
video gamey.
Yeah, they did have kind of that hive mentality, though, like the Shingu bird-like characters did.
Sorry, I'm looking for that swords and ad. You know what? That would be meandering this dialogue, much
that,
like
that
the
would,
story
be,
of Valerian and a Thousand Cities, because, again, that's for me. The sad thing is the sordid planet sequence occurs in at a scene in the film that could, it could easily be edited out of the entire film and wouldn't have changed anything. So that's kind of sad. But as a sordid planet appreciator, the whole sequence makes me think of, you know, like Tatooine scenes in Star Wars, John Carter, Jabba's Palace in Return of the Jedi, all those kind of like sandy alien worlds that have kind of like futuristic fortresses that are kind of built out of stone, maybe a little man-ish maybe. And that sequence has all of that. Even though the aliens, to me, even though they're going to eat people and they've got swords, they're not the most intimidating-looking aliens.
No,
like
they're not.
They are definitely played for comic relief. In fact, you know, one of them's trying to dress Lorraine in all these different dresses, and it's the snickering and giggling and spitting his sneezes on her and everything. So they're not like the Thark and John Carter, which, you know, they're just as tribal. But the Thark,
that was the group I was trying to get from the
John Carter? Yeah, the Thark, they've got multi-arms, spears in each arm, they've got skulls on their head, you know, that of wearing their enemies in a battle. Those guys are threatening. They scare me. The guys in Valerian, no.
No, in fact, the guys that are the most scary are the ambassador's robots, commander's robots.
Yeah, they're the most threatening-looking critters in the film, actually.
Well, they're very totalitarian-looking.
But the sword and planet sequence of Valerian. So that, I know we've been doing a series of podcasts on sword and planet, but there's still kind of some other aspects of Valerian that we like to talk about. And I think one of them is kind of, again, going back to the setting. The setting is awesome. This is one of those. It's just not often that, you know, you do a really good space setting. And every time, and we talked about this when we talked about John Carter, it's like in the last 10, 15 years, anytime they tried to start a new franchise in space that's not Star Wars, they just bomb. Like Jupiter Ascending, oh man, it's going to be the sweeping epic that crosses all these movies, bombed. Valerian, bombed. John Carter, bombed. I think there's a couple other ones. We saw it. It was more of a young adult film. It's called, like, I Am Number Four or something.
That's the name of it, I Am Number Four.
Yeah, which was more on Earth, but still it had a lot of, you know, came from space-type stuff. Failed, you know.
That was actually a halfway decent film. We actually enjoyed that one.
But where's the sequels? Where's I Am Number Five?
Yeah, and I mean, it did finish off that there could be a sequel, and unfortunately there was no sequel.
It's just, you know, unless you're Star Wars or if you're Star Trek going to TV, because even the Star Wars movies, after movie number three, they gave up. They're just like, we can't compete with Star Wars. We're just going to go small screen instead. And now Star Wars is small screen now with Mandalorian and other stuff.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So it's hard to compete. And the thing is how do you compete against Star Wars in the space opera arena? And there are ways to do it. You just got to do things differently and better. And I think Valerian, in a kind of Babylon 5 sort of way, because Babylon 5, like Star Trek Deep Space Nine, you know, all took place in one setting.
Mm-hmm.
You could make a Valerian universe, have it set on Alpha City, keep them as secret agents, and they're going to different sectors of the city, you know, as ambassadors or secret agents or whatever. You could do so much with it, and every now and then they leave Alpha City and go to another planet. You can make it into a cartoon. I don't know, but
it's funny that you bring up Babylon 5.
Because
in my readings here, there is mention that the Valerian comic book series did have some, you know, influence on Babylon 5 as a conceptualizing, influencing comic book series. Babylon 5 was kind of influenced by the Valerian series.
I can believe that.
Mm-hmm.
I should say this about the film, because one of the guys who created the comic books actually worked at Heavy Metal, and there are frames from this film that look like a cover from, like, late 70s, early 80s Heavy Metal magazine with, you know, like, girls in armor with axes with a dragon, but like a futuristic city behind them. There's a lot of that stuff in Valerian that looks straight out of Heavy Metal. So I'm going to have to say there's some cross-pollination there.
Oh, definitely, because the person that you're speaking of is the artist who is Jean-Claude Mézier. He did work with Bazin on The Fifth Element. He also, like you said, he did work with Heavy Metal, and so his art and his vision has been influential as well.
Yeah, I don't know too much about the comics. I was a big Tintin fan, and I know Tintin's influence, but I do know a lot of those European / French and Italian comics did have splashes on, you know, 80s and 90s comics, especially Indian underground comics. I know, like Kevin Eastman owned Heavy Metal for a while, so there's definitely like influence on Ninja Turtles and all that fun stuff. So, yeah. I could see Valerian and Laura Lane definitely having influence on other aspects of pop culture that are probably overshadowed by, you know, George
Lucas. You know, they talked about, you know, Star Wars, like the Tatooine scene with the cantina being influenced by the Valerian series. Other influences, Conan the Barbarian, some of the sets in the film from the 80s, Independence Day, some of the ships and things like that influenced Independence Day. So I feel like this is the comic series and the art from it is very influential. It's just that it's downplayed because, you know, this is a foreign comic, and it's not like it's readily something that somebody is necessarily going to read. You do have to go kind of out of your way to find it and read it and see make those connections and how it influences our media.
wonder how much the comics was influenced by like old serials like Buck Rogers and stuff.
Yeah, you would think a lot, and unfortunately, you know, I didn't find a whole lot of, you know, that kind of cyclical influence, you know, from the American comics, other than what was being portrayed in the comics. Like the American superheroes in the 60s and things like that. But I'm sure they were looking at Flash Gordon and, you know, mm-hmm. Buck Rogers and things like that.
So it would be a great role-playing game, too.
You know, that's the thing. All these ambitious space operas that don't quite get off, they could definitely turn them into MMORPGs, video games, tabletop RPGs, you know, because they do a lot of world building. And I think that's one thing that they do very well in all these failed films. Jupiter Ascending has a cool world, even mm-hmm. though it's got its issues. Even the John Carter Barsoom, it's still a very interesting world of different, you know, factions of folks vying for power and whatnot. It's just not the best executed film.
But you could use Barsoom yeah. as kind of the base of operation. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, there's so much creativity by mm-hmm. people that are writing the stories nowadays and writing the modules for these very tabletops.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's no reason why they can't create new creatures and worlds and bring them together into a foundational piece.
I think Valerian would make a great graphical MMORPG, like World of Warcraft or something.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, they've got a lot of room to play, and it would have been great if this movie had been more successful. What's interesting is that even though it did make money, it didn't make enough in which to, you know, guarantee a sequel.
It's those marketing costs. You know,
it truly is. It's the marketing. Yeah.
The marketing worked on me because I remember, I didn't know squat about Valerian, but we were at the Cinemark Theater on Catella. We were there to see Something Else.
Mm-hmm.
And we're, you know, you walk through the halls and they have these, you know, coming soon posters, and they had a coming soon for Valerian. And I looked at it and all I saw was giant spaceship. It wasn't that poster, but it was a different one, but you know, giant spaceship and whatever, and like, ooh, I detect space opera. And you know what? Uh-huh. I'm the target audience, you know. Mm-hmm. I like space operas and I like sci-fi and I like that type of stuff. So that one poster, you know, and unfortunately the movie did not live up to the poster. But marketing costs, I tell ya.
I think what's also interesting about Sword and Planet films is the fact that it does open up the imagination for all these other species and what alien races might be out there. So I think that creates a lot of imagination through these films.
And I think to go off that, I don't think you could really do a solo Sword and Planet film anymore. And I think John Carter is testament to that, its failure. Mm-hmm. But like the essay in my book, another shameless plug, says, you know, this is genre like Legos. Well, I'm saying that, not the essay. You know, you can attach it to other genres. And like, overtly, I wouldn't call Valerian a Sword and Planet film. It just has a Sword and Planet sequence in it. Mm-hmm. But you know, if you use that as your first Lego, then you've got a film that's a space opera, a secret agent film,
a love story.
Love story.
Or an effort to be one.
A combat film, you know, all that fun stuff. So, and I think we've talked about this before, even the sword and sandal genre just can't stand on its own today. It's got to be combined with something else. It's got to be in a superhero film. It's got to be, you know, made for young adults like the, what's that young adult series called?
Twilight?
Not Twilight.
Oh, okay.
The
Hunger Games?
No. But they're like actual like Greek deities running around.
Blood of Zeus?
Oh, Percy Jackson.
Percy Jackson, thank you.
Okay.
I'll get there yet.
No, like, I'll get get there. Nick, you're supposed to be an expert on sword and sandal, and you can't even recall Percy Jackson. It's been a long day at work, people. But I think Sword and Planet is a great building block for other genres, and like you're saying, bring in some other stuff as well. You it's Sword and Planet, that aspect of it is other races, other civilizations, other cultures, other mm-hmm. architecture, weird cool ships, weird cool places in the galaxy. You can throw a Cthulhu in there. Sword and Planet and Cthulhu, why not?
Well, and I do realize that if Besson had focused the story a bit more, redressed the main characters, and, you know, focus in on whatever story he was going to tell, whether it's a love story, it's a little bit more buddy-buddy type of story. You know, I really do think that he had a formula for success there, and he had the formula there for teasing just enough of what the potential was in this entire world. You know, it just is too bad that it didn't succeed, mm-hmm. because I think this had, out of everything that we've seen, I think this had the most overwhelming opportunity and potential of going off in a lot of different directions.
You know, overwhelming is a way to phrase it. It's both the movie's strength and its kind of weakness at mm-hmm. the same time. I feel like we bragged on the film a little too much. If you had to narrow it down to one thing, it's the main dude. If you can get past the main dude, the movie's highly recommendable, especially for its spectacle. It is incredibly fun and incredibly visual. And I'd say, you know who actually, this movie is similar to Ice Pirates in that sense that the universe has lots of races and aliens and, mm-hmm. you know, crew of folks. It's just that the hero in Ice Pirates actually had charisma. I forget his name. Robert York. Bring him in. Bring his ghost in. He could be hilarious.
Bring his son.
What's the better space opera here? Ice Pirates or Valerian?
Well, I just want to say though, with regards to this one, oh crap! I just lost what I was going to say. Never mind. I don't remember.
I ran out and got Ice Pirates when you described it because you drew mythic parallels to Jason and the Argonauts, so I had to see it, and I did. I ordered it from Amazon right away. Valerian, I'm thinking I could wait a little bit to watch it. It sounded like fun, and maybe they made him that way because maybe 12-year-olds were the target audience. So this way, a 12-year-old who plays video games could associate with Valerian, maybe?
You know what, when you say that, because I think another film that came out roughly the same time was Ready Player One. And okay. I just think that there's a scale visual overlap, not a story overlap, because Ready Player One, we haven't seen it, but I know that's way into retro and video games, but I also know it's also in a big expansive world that's very CGI, and you know, and I think the protagonist, that's a young adult or maybe even a kid. It's definitely supposed to be more on the younger folk side, so I could kind of see, you know, Valerian has to go up against Ready Player One. I'm always saying it, you know, he's not a 12-year-old kid. The guy's in his 20s, but he just,
he's actually 30.
When they made Valerian? Or is he 35
now? No, he's 35 now.
So he was 29 when they, but he's so baby.
But Kara uh-huh. Is like 6 years younger than him.
Yeah.
So think how old she was.
Yeah, but she actually looks mature.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So I will say that Ready Player One came out in 2018, so 1 year later.
Okay.
I do remember now what I was going to say about Valerian is that for individuals that really enjoyed The Fifth Element, the humor, mm-hmm. would definitely like this film as well.
It is enjoyable. The visual spectacle, there are some gags here and there that are perfectly executed. Yeah, like Michelle saying, the fun aspects of Fifth Element is cranked up to 11 in this film. So that definitely, I would, you know what, I would recommend it over John Carter, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think I would too, particularly since we've seen it a second time, and I definitely enjoyed it better the second time. It's a 2 hour plus film, but it goes quickly. Even though there's a lot of meandering, it is a fast watch.
This movie needs like an editor's cut where someone goes in and fits the meanderings, because then it will probably be a 90-minute film. And unfortunately, the Sordid Planet scene would have to go, because as much as I like the sequence as a genre, it adds nothing to the film overall, unfortunately, like in the term of character development or, you know, because usually when you have meanders, every meandering, the character walks away with something like a new ally, a new item, a new bit of information. Valerian just doesn't do that.
Yeah, the ally that they would have doesn't make it. And the lesson is so minor that you could have included that lesson in another part of the film that is in there.
Yeah.
So.
Anyway, so I think that finishes off our Sword and Planet discussions for 2021. I know
yes,
we still
does.
Got some more to talk about. We got Herculoids coming up, and we're excited to talk about Yore in the upcoming episode, because we love Yore.
Yeah, we haven't done Yore in a while. That is awesome. I'm also going to invite you to a new adventure. We're doing horror and the paranormal, and the shows will range from everything from like popular culture, you know, horror and video games and comics and stories and movies and so on, to paranormal explorations of these types of entities or creatures. So, if you want to play in that playground, you're more than welcome to. That's going to be I did a few test shows, and they went pretty well. So I'm going to be doing a lot more of it in 2022.
Oh, yeah. We definitely would be interested in that.
Yeah, Michelle's definitely a fan of ghosts and paranormal.
Oh, yeah. Very much so.
Awesome. I'd love to have you guys along. And unfortunately, our conversation for today, we only have a couple more minutes left, but I enjoyed listening to you. Thank you for giving me background on the Valerian. And again, I'm going to wait on it for a little bit longer. But how can people get in contact with you? How can they enter the wonderful worlds that you open up for them?
Well, I have a author page on Amazon where you can find the books that I've either edited or I'm part of. I also have a website, michellebrittany.com, that I will probably start updating in the new year. That's one of my New Year's resolutions. How about you, Nick?
I'm at nickdiak.com. From there is all my social media links and some of my essays on the sword and somethings genre, because that's what I write about, and cocktails as well. You find a link to all of our podcasts there, from HP Lovecast to all of our appearances on your show. And I also do a weekly roundup of not just personal news and accomplishments of both Michelle and I, but I do a weekly roundup of Peplum news, you know, what's going on in the Peplum world out there, you know, new books or movies and games coming out.
And unfortunate people that have passed away that have been part of the that genre in the past.
Yeah, rest in peplums are always kind of sad, but they brought us so much. But yeah, I'm at nickdiak.com, and from there is a gateway to everything, like a city of 1,000 planets.
Oh,
ta-da! Thank you so very much again. Happy holiday to both of you. And a wonderful new year. May the coming year bring you everything your heart desires. Much joy, much prosperity, and much personal fulfillment.
Oh, thank you, Hercules, and to you and to your lovely, lovely lady. And thanks to all the listeners who've tuned in over this past year. We really appreciate you being part of our journey, and we look forward to next year.
Very well said. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. And we are going to conclude with If You Can Dream by Ginger Ackley. Thanks again. Michelle, thanks again.
Thanks, Hercules.
If you can dream, if you can fly, then your heart can touch the sky. But only if you can dream. If love is true and love is real, pain and sorrow soon will heal. But only if